told you last week when we were studying in chapter 3 that I didn't want to jump off into Habakkuk 2:4 late in our study because we were running out of time and there's a lot of really neat things that are contained in the issue of Paul's use of Habakkuk 2:4 in his statement in chapter 3, verse 11. No one is justified by the law before God is evident because, and then he quotes Habakkuk 2:4. So he's actually using Habakkuk 2:4 to prove that no one is justified by the law before God. And I really am amazed to some degree at how clear that is and how badly we've been treated as readers of the translators, because the translators act like that's not his point. Paul is the apostle of relational truth. His apostleship was designed to set forth the gospel of God as a reality that functions at the level of relationships. He didn't spend a whole lot of time trying to figure out the math and the physics and all that kind of stuff of a physical universe, because he knew that the physical universe is only a subset of a greater, more critical reality, and that's the relational one, where you relate to people, persons. And it's out of those relationships that all pain and suffering and all glory and joy come. I mean, you can get bent out of shape because your car won't start, but there is nothing that can give you the same level of joy as a good relationship, and nothing can give you as great a level of pain as the loss of one. And even God himself has called us to relate to him. So Paul, as an apostle of relational truth, shows a decided interest in how people live. And you can tell that because when you read his letters, they're just full of exhortations. Do this, don't do that, you know, get involved in this, don't get involved in that. All the way through, all these epistles, they're just all kinds of instruction, commands, and so on. And that shows that he's interested in how we live. But he also shows a determined interest in whether the approach that people take to living will actually lead to life. You can be told, don't do this or do this, and that's how you are going to function. But if you do this or you don't do that with a messed up foundation, the how is wiped out because the foundation's bad. And that's the reason why Paul was always pressing down into the understanding of the relational universe, so that we don't ever just do something. There's always got to be a compelling something behind that that says, yeah, this is a good thing to be involved in, so we do it. This is a horrible thing to be involved in, so we abstain from it. So when we look at Galatians as a book, where do you suppose we're going to find the first actual exhortation to do something? Have we run across one yet? In the three chapters that we've studied, do you remember Paul commanding you to do anything? I mean, he castigates the Galatians for some things that they have done, and I can't believe you guys have departed from him who called you so quickly and stuff like that, but that's not a command. It's just an observation on his part. So where do you suppose they're going to find the first command? Well, I didn't find one until I got to chapter 4, verse 12. Which, and you don't need to go there. We're not going to be talking about that command. But the point is that when you look at the book of Galatians, which is dealing with how you respond to the grace of God so that you can live effectively, as opposed to responding to the law of God, which will kill you dead in a hammer, in that letter, he doesn't tell you to do anything until an extensive foundation has been laid. And that fits his thesis. If he starts off telling you what to do, you're just going to be into the law right off the bat. And he's not interested in getting the Galatians to do anything until they are properly motivated and know why they're going to do whatever it is that he wants them to do. And in fact, in chapter 4, verse 12, where he actually gives his first... If I read it right, I mean, I skimmed over it. I didn't really go carefully through it to make sure that chapter 4, verse 12 is the first command. But if that's the first command, basically it's just a command to, hey, try to be like I am in regard to what I'm doing to you. I'm not your enemy. I don't hate you. I'm not saying all these things because I got a mad on against you or whatever. Become like I am in terms of your attitude toward me. Take on the same attitude I have toward you. In other words, be aware that my interest in you is good. It's a loving interest. It's intended for your best interest. Whatever I've said up to this point was not designed to irritate you and make you mad and cause you to get angry and all that. He said some hard things, like chapter 3, verse 1, you fools. But never with the intention of trying to stir a pot so that you'll just get angry with me. So we have to draw a conclusion from the reality that he gives no commands in the first four chapters until you get halfway through the fourth one. And I think the conclusion is that Paul isn't interested in anybody doing anything until they know how to do it. I mean, we can't do that as human beings in most of the settings of our lives. We've got a whole generation of people who think that that's the way they should raise their kids. Until the kids understand and you can reason with them and all, you really shouldn't make a lot of rules. Well, that won't work. You have to set boundaries. You have to make demands. You have to enforce them. Whether kids understand it or not, beside the point. But the fact is, when you enforce behavior, you just create rule followers. And you can wish your kids would obey you because they love you, but they don't love you that much. So you have to force them to obey you, okay? Hopefully, as they get older, they'll start to love you, but maybe not. But in a relational universe where the truth is paramount, God's not interested in people just being forced to do stuff the right way. He wants them to operate out of a legitimate basis. So there's a good reason for Paul's focus on the first 3.5 chapters being teaching stuff, and that is that doing, taking action, is an extremely dangerous and also potentially extremely productive in a cause and effect universe. If you do it, it's going to set up a whole chain of reactions that can be enormously disastrous or enormously beneficial. That's why in a cause and effect universe, you have to be really, really careful when you set something in motion, because it's going to run. And you are going to reap it sooner or later. That's what he says at the end of the book, chapter 6. Don't be deceived. We live in a cause and effect universe. You knock that first domino off, and the whole thing's going to go. So in Galatians, Paul is clearly intent on setting about to make as sure as possible that his readers have a legitimate methodology for living before he tells them how to live in terms of particulars. He wants them to have a methodology for life before he tells them, okay, now that you have the methodology in mind, do this and don't do that. So this evening what we're going to do is look at the second truth regarding the methodology. Because in chapter 3, verses 6 through 14, he is actually doing his methodology presentation. And he's saying you have two choices. You can do it as an outworking of your focus on law, or you can do it as an outworking of your focus on grace. And those are the only two options there are. I mean, other than just rebellion, and you're just not going to do anything that God wants you to do. So that's the third option. But he's not writing to people like that. He's writing to people who have some interest in doing the right thing. But doing the right thing means doing it with the right motivation. And there are only two motivations for doing anything, and that's one's law and one's grace. So he's already said in verse 10, and we looked at that last time, that if you approach the issue of relating to God on the basis of law, you put yourself under a curse, and it's going to be totally destructive. And the alternative is, verse 11, where faith is introduced into the mix. That nobody is justified by the law before God is obvious, he says, because the Bible says, the just by faith shall live. So that brings us to the issue of his quote from Habakkuk 2:4. The truth about methodology in verse 11, the righteous by faith shall live, is that the method that produces life is the method that starts with believing something God has said. In other words, it's your confidence in God and what is said that enables you to move in the direction of living. And it's not what you do for God, it's what He has done and said that you become convinced of that sponsors your behavior. And the proof of that, according to this text, is Habakkuk 2:4. That brings us to the translation issues that I just mentioned briefly last time, and some of you have heard this study in some other form before, and you know that Habakkuk 2:4 is a critical text. Paul uses it in Romans chapter 1 at the beginning of his presentation of the gospel of God, and he says that the gospel is the power of God unto salvation, and he says the reason is because there is in it a revelation of a righteousness that is by faith and for faith, and he quotes Habakkuk 2:4. And then in Galatians chapter 3, verse 11, he says, Habakkuk 2:4 proves, makes it as obvious as it can be, that a man will not be justified before God by the law. And then whoever wrote Hebrews also quotes Habakkuk in chapter 10, I believe it is, that has to do with the issue of being justified by faith and whether life will work out from that. The thing that I want to point out about these quotes in the New Testament from Habakkuk 2:4, obviously Habakkuk 2:4 is a crucial text for the New Testament. If Paul's going to start his presentation of the gospel of God in Romans with Habakkuk 2:4, well then obviously that's a critical text. If the proof that the methodology of the law will not work with God is Habakkuk 2:4, then we need to understand Habakkuk 2:4. And if Hebrews argues that our life is tied up in whether or not we grasp the significance of Habakkuk 2:4, then we need to understand Habakkuk 2:4. So, that's my rationale for focusing on Habakkuk 2:4 in relation to Galatians 3:11. We're studying Galatians, but Galatians is what quotes Habakkuk, so we're going to be looking a little bit at Habakkuk. The first thing I want to point out is, I haven't seen all of the English translations, but the ones I've seen invariably mistranslate the text. Which text do you have? What does it say? At the end of verse 11 in the quote.
What has the end of verse 11?
Of chapter 3 of Galatians. How does it translate Habakkuk 2:4?
The righteous one will live by faith.
Okay. Which text do you have, Heather? And what does it say?
Verse 11, the righteous man shall live by faith.
And you have the NASB? Uh-huh. And Deanna has the NASB. What do you have?
The NIV.
And what does it say?
It says, the righteous will live by faith.
By faith? Mm-hmm. Kelly, what have you got?
I've got the NASB.
Okay.
I have the ESV.
The what? ASV?
The
ESV. The English Standard?
It says, the righteous shall live by faith.
Okay. Now, one thing about this translation is that's universal among English translations, apparently. It's at least universal among this one. And it's wrong. The Hebrew from Habakkuk 2:4 and all of the Greek texts, including the Septuagint translation of Habakkuk 2:4 from the Hebrew into Greek, and all of the Greek texts in the New Testament, all say, the righteous by faith shall live. So the word order is significantly different. And you say, well, what's the difference if the righteous shall live by faith or the righteous by faith shall live? Well, what is the difference? How you got righteous or how you're supposed to live? Exactly. And what's Paul's point in Galatians 3:11 in terms of, is he trying to say how you got righteous or how you're supposed to live? How you got righteous. He says, that no one is righteous by the law before God is obvious, because the righteous by faith shall live. Now, in terms of commas, we know that the punctuation in the Bible is not inspired. The Greek and Hebrew didn't have punctuation, okay? But for our sake, I'm going to put some punctuation in here. It's the righteous by faith, comma, shall live. That's different than the righteous, comma, shall live by faith. Because the difference is, if you translate the righteous shall live by faith, you're talking about how a person should go about living. That's not Paul's point. And I want that really clear because it's crucial in terms of what Paul is doing here. What he's doing here is using Habakkuk 2:4 in its word order in Hebrew as well as in the Septuagint. The righteous, who are righteous by faith, shall live. In other words, it's a promise that if you're righteous by faith, you will live. Now, do you remember the setting of Habakkuk? I mean, we covered this in some other kind of thing. You remember the setting of Habakkuk? 2 years before the Babylonian captivity. And Habakkuk, let's go over to Habakkuk and look at what's going on there. If you're like me, you're going to have to look for it, because... Yeah, it's after Nahum, and that's after Jonah and Micah. It's after Daniel. Habakkuk 2:4 says in the New American Standard Translation, "For behold, as for the proud one, his soul is not right within him." And then I'm gonna insist that we change the translation. "But the righteous by faith shall live." Now, that's the promise. Why is it made? Well, back up. If you read Habakkuk 1:1 through 2:3, you'll discover that what's going on is Habakkuk is complaining to God because the mystery of iniquity, and he doesn't use this terminology, but what's happening is we're 607. We're 607 B.C. From the time Moses led the children of Israel out of Egypt, somewhere back in maybe the 14th or 15th century B.C., so 1,000 years before, Moses got the national identity and stuff started. But for 1,000 years, Judah and Israel have been absolutely pathetic in their loyalty to God. So often that God has had to discipline them and discipline them, and that's what the book of Judges is. It's a whole cycle of Israel going astray and God hammering them with some other nation, and then they cry out to God for deliverance and he sends them a judge. And Samson and, you know, all those guys. The point is, for 1,000 years, the prophets of Israel and Judah cried out against Israel and Judah for their apostasy from Yahweh, God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. They would go after the Baalim and the Asheroth and all of those other gods of the nations, and they would just do all kinds of... The prophets called it prostitution. They prostituted themselves to these other gods, trying to serve these other gods, and ignoring the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. For 1,000 years, the prophets of Israel and Judah cried out against this. But it kept getting worse. It's called the mystery of iniquity. It just gets worse and worse and worse the longer it goes. So for 1,000 years, it's been going on. Now, in 722, God got tired of it with the northern tribes, what was called Israel. And he sent the Assyrians in and carried them off into captivity, and they were never heard of again. Just a little over 100 years later, Judah is in the same condition that Israel had been in. And God's come to the point where he's not going to put up with it anymore. He's going to send Judah into captivity. The difference is going to be that when he sends Judah into captivity, he's got it already nailed down. It's going to be 70 years. And this 70-year period of captivity is going to address the apostasy of Judah. And after they go back to the land, Nehemiah and those guys, Ezra, When they go back in the land, you're never going to hear the prophets crying out against the apostasy of Israel as they chase after other gods. Not going to happen, because they're going to learn. The 70 years is going to crush their tendency to be apostate in terms of who the God is. Now, they'll be apostate in a lot of other things, but not in terms of who the God is. So, what we have here is 2 years before God is going to discipline Judah, before he's going to drop the hammer on this apostate nation. 2 years before that, there's a prophet in Judah named Habakkuk, and he's complaining, God, everywhere I look, everything's wrong. It doesn't matter where I turn, I can't find anything being done according to your word. Nothing is right. Everything's wrong. How long are you going to put up with this garbage? And God says, well, not long. He says, verse 5 of chapter 1, look among the nations, be astonished, wonder, I'm going to do something in your days that you're not going to believe it, even if I tell you. I'm going to raise up the Chaldeans, and the rest of this thing is I'm going to send the Chaldeans into your setting. Verse 11, they're going to sweep through like the wind and pass on. Their strength is their own God. And Habakkuk says, no, you can't do that. I didn't mean it. I didn't mean it. I want you to get radical on me here. You know, just kind of straighten things up a little bit. God says, starting chapter 1, verse 12, Habakkuk is reacting to God's statement. I'm going to send the Babylonians in there and clean your plow. Now, the Babylonians were horrible people. They deliberately slaughtered women that were pregnant. They would rip their stomachs open to take their babies out and dash the babies against the rocks to kill them. They were horrible people. And Habakkuk knows that. And he's saying to God, you can't do that. I mean, as bad as we are, we're not that bad. You can't use the Chaldeans against us. We're more holy than they are. And he goes into this whole thing in verses 12 and following in chapter 1 about how God, you can't do this. You can't do this. They're horrible. You can't do this. And at the chapter 2, verse 1, he says, I'm going to stand my guard. I'm going to station myself on the rampart. I'm going to see how God answers my objections. Because I've already told him, verse 13, you're too pure to approve evil. You can't look on wickedness with favor. You're not going to let the Babylonians do that. That would be totally out of line. You can't do this. Now I'm going to see what he answers. And what's God's answer? Verse 2 of chapter 2. Write it down. Verse 3, the vision is yet for the appointed time. It hastens toward its goal, and it will not fail. It will come. In other words, God says to Habakkuk, I've heard everything you said. Write it down. It's going to happen. You can object all you want to. The Babylonians are coming. Now, that's verse 3 of chapter 2. Verse 4 is the next verse. But before we go to verse 4, I want you to go to chapter 3 and look at what's going on from a backward look. In chapter 3, verse 16, almost to the end of the book, Habakkuk says this about his reaction to God's declaration he's going to bring the Chaldeans in. He said in verse 16, I heard, and my inward parts trembled. At the sound, my lips quivered. Decay enters my bones, and in my place I tremble, because I have to wait quietly for the day of distress for the people to arise who will invade us. And God has said, it's going to happen. There's nothing I can do about it. Write it down. It's going to happen. So here I am. I'm locked into having to just wait until it happens. And I'm scared spitless. Decay has entered my bones, and in my place I tremble. This is the end of chapter 2, verse 3. This is his emotional reaction. I am consigned to wait for the vision. It's going to happen. There's nothing I can do about it. It's horrible. I can't believe it's going to be this bad. It's going to be horrible. It's just like... And then there's a total change in verse 17. Though the fig tree should not blossom, there be no fruit on the vines, though the yield of the olive should fail and the fields produce no food, the flock should be cut off from the fold and no cattle in the stalls, yet I will exult in the Lord. I will rejoice in the God of my deliverance, my salvation. The Lord God is my strength, and He has made my feet like hinds' feet and makes me walk on my high places. Now, what changed from verse 16 to verse 17? He went from being scared spitless to exulting in the God of his deliverance. Well, I'm going to suggest to you that verse 4 is what happened. Chapter 2. And what happened in verse 4 of chapter 2 is this. God said to Habakkuk, because at the end of verse 3, God could see Habakkuk trembling. He could see the decay entering into his bones. He could see the fatalistic despair settle over him because God has said, I've heard every objection and it's still going to happen. Just write it down. I'm going to do that. I told you before I told you that you wouldn't believe me. If I told you, now I've told you, you still don't. You know, it's going to happen, Habakkuk. And he has seen the impact of this statement to Habakkuk from himself on Habakkuk's soul. And he sees the despair and depression just settle over him like a thick fog. So verse 4 says, behold, as for the proud one, his soul's not right within him, but the righteous by faith shall live. That changed Habakkuk's entire attitude according to chapter 3. That's what caused him to begin to exult in the God of his deliverance, his salvation. Because what God said was, Habakkuk, it is going to be as bad as you say, except for those who are justified by faith. They're going to live. So you mean, God, that when the Babylonians come in here with their weapons, their swords and their maces and their archer, you know, their bows and their arrows and their all this weapons of war, that the ones that are justified by faith are not going to be put to death? And God says, that's exactly what I said. That's what I said right there, that just by faith will live. You mean I can't get killed here? No, you can't get killed here. If you're justified by faith, you're going to make it. Now, I don't know how in the world God ever got that to happen. I mean, the Babylonians weren't looking for a mark on the forehead that says, don't kill this one, this one's God's. But they pulled their bows back and shot their arrows, and wherever those arrows went, but God said, if you were justified by faith, you would not be killed by this invasion. You would not be put to death by the Babylonian antagonism toward Judah. It was out of that promise that the book of Daniel arose. Of all of the books in the Bible, the book of Daniel has a sterling, exalted position in terms of the phenomenal stories. I mean, it's the book of Daniel where Daniel is told he's going to be executed by the king because the wise men of Babylon can't tell the king what his dream means. And Daniel says, give me 24 hours. And 24 hours he walks into the king's chamber and he says, King, the God of heaven has told me what you dreamed and what it meant. And so he tells him what he dreamed and then he tells him what he meant. God spares Daniel and his three friends because of a miracle. Daniel knows what the king dreamed in his night vision. And not only that, but he knows what it means because God told him. And then you have this other story about these three guys who are Jewish and they're going to be loyal to Yahweh, God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And the king says, no, you're not. You're going to bow to my golden image, 90 feet tall, plated in gold. You're going to bow to that. That's the only way I can make my kingdom endure forever is if everybody worships the same God, and you're going to worship my God, or I'm going to burn you in a furnace of fire, and you resist me, and there isn't a God around that can deliver you out of my hand. And these three men say, well, our God can, and he said he would, and so we're going to depend on that. But even if we've misunderstood, and you're not going to make us worship your God, that's not happening, and it makes the king so angry, he says, heat that furnace up 7 times hotter than it's supposed to be, and throw those jerks in there! And they do. And the guys who throw them in die, because it's so hot. And the king stands back, and he looks in there, and he sees these three guys walking around, and all of a sudden there's another guy in there. And he says, how many did we throw in there? Three. How come I see four and one of them looks like a son of the gods? So he calls them out. The other significant story in the book of Daniel is Daniel in the lion's den. God, Daniel's 80, 90 years old. The king says, you can't ask anything from anybody but me for 30 days, or I'm going to throw you in the den of lions. Mommy, can I have a bottle of milk? Into the lion's den you go. You didn't ask the king. I mean, that's a dumb rule. But nonetheless, Daniel says, I'm going to still talk to my God, and I'm still going to pray. And so he goes up and he prays, and they catch him talking to his God, and they say, you violated the king's rule, so you go in the den of lion. And Daniel goes to the lion den, and the king's, oh, he said, that is so stupid of me. How did I get caught up in this ego stuff? Now I'm going to lose the best guy I've got in my whole kingdom because of my stupid rules. He says, Daniel, can your God do anything about this? So he throws him in the den of lion. Next morning, the king's out there early saying, Daniel, are you still alive? And Daniel says, yeah, I'm still alive. So they pull him up out of the den, and they throw the guys that created the rule in the first place in. The lions crush their bones before they ever hit the floor. Those are the stories that all the people of God, ever since they happened, have thrilled over. And what was the foundation for them? Habakkuk 2:4. Daniel and Hananiah and Mishael and Azariah believed that God said, if you are justified by faith, you will live. That means, I don't care what the king says, you're not going to die. That means if the king says, I'm going to burn you a fire, that you say, well, try it. But our God is able to deliver us, and he will. And by the time Daniel is 80 years old, you know, he's been through this rigmarole so many times, he knows good and well that they can't. The antagonism of the apostates in Israel or Judah and the Babylonians cannot kill him. So they say, well, we're going to feed you the lions. So feed me to them. But the point is, they're doing this because Habakkuk 2:4 said that if you were justified by faith, the antagonism of Babylon cannot kill you. That doesn't mean you won't die from old age or, you know, but the antagonism of Babylon will not kill you. And they lived these phenomenal experiences that nobody else in the history of the world has ever experienced before or since. Because Habakkuk 2:4 had said, if you are justified by faith, if God has declared you righteous because you have believed him, and he has declared you righteous on the basis of your believing him, like Genesis 15:6, Abraham believed him and God counted it to him for righteousness. If you have believed God and he has counted to you for righteousness, if you have been justified by faith, you are going to live through this Babylonian thing. And it doesn't matter what the Babylonians decide to do. It is not going to happen to you. That's God's word to that generation. And those few who believed him discovered and lived out the reality of the promise. Now, keep in mind, the promise was not, if you are justified by faith, the Babylonians won't carry you off into captivity. He didn't say that. He didn't say, if you're justified by faith, your life is always going to be peachy and all that. He didn't say that. He just said this, if you're justified by faith, those Babylonians are not going to be able to kill you. Believe it or not, that's the promise I'm going to make. And Habakkuk's reaction to that promise was an immediate, emotional, 180-degree flip. He had been bowed down by the disturbing message. He was overwhelmed by the disaster that was to come. And God said, write it down, it's going to happen. And Habakkuk says, I'm consigned to just wait until this terrible thing happens. And then God turns right around and says, but it isn't going to happen to you, Habakkuk. You're one of those who's trusted me, and I've justified you, and you're going to live through this. And so quit being so down in the mouth about it. And Habakkuk's reaction is, all right, I will exult in the God of my deliverance. It doesn't matter what happens. God is my life and my shield, and I'm going to exult in him. And it was a huge shift. So So the point that I'm trying to make here is that when Paul appealed to Habakkuk 2:4 in Galatians 3:11, he was actually appealing to a text in the Old Testament that was a premier and categorical text for how you're to be declared righteous by God, and it is by faith. And I want you to notice the differences and the similarities before we run out of time between Habakkuk 2:4, which is quoted in Galatians 3:11, and Genesis 15:6, which is quoted in Galatians 3:6. In Genesis, in Abraham's experience, there was no scenario of disaster on the horizon that we know about. Habakkuk's setting is an enormous scenario of disaster. But that's the only difference. What was really the same in both cases was this. In Genesis 15, Abraham wants something so bad he can taste it and he can't have it. And he is complaining to God because he has no heir and this slave is going to be his heir. And God, I want a son. And Habakkuk saying, God, I don't want to die. So basically they're both expressing the gut of their want, their desire. And God addresses both of them with a promise. To Abraham, he says, enumerate the stars if you can. This is what your seed's going to be like. It's not going to be Eliezer of Damascus. And Abraham believes him, and God justifies him, and he goes about his business. Habakkuk hears God say, the Chaldeans are coming, and there's nothing you can do to stop that from happening. Write it down, it's going to happen. It's going to happen. But Habakkuk, it's not going to happen to you. Because you've trusted me. You're righteous in my eyes because of faith, not because of the way you've lived. And because of that, it's not going to happen to you. And Habakkuk says, all right. Now, my point is, Genesis 15:6 is the first time in the Bible we're told how man was declared righteous by God. And it was not by works of the law. It was because he believed him. And Habakkuk 2:4, in a very real sense, may be the last time in the Old Testament that you run into a clear-cut declaration of how a person is justified by God. And it's by faith. Now, in both cases, the outcome is life. But the issue is not, how shall you live? The issue is, will you live? And the answer is, yeah, if you're justified by faith. And so the message is that a person who approaches God on the basis of faith now has a methodology for living. That's Paul's point in Galatians. The law is not a methodology for living. You cannot do what God commands you to do sufficiently well that he can't shred your doing with all kinds of nitpicky complaints. If you're going to approach God on the basis of trying to prove to him that you're obedient, you're loyal, you're faithful, you know, that ain't going to work. In a relational universe, you don't enter into a relationship based on, here, let me prove how good I can obey you. That won't work. You try that, you're going to come under a curse and you're going to die. In a relational universe, the real issue of relationship, the real issue is twofold. Number one, what do you love? And who do you believe? And that's Genesis 3, folks. From the beginning, the problem was Adam and Eve didn't believe God. They believed the serpent instead. And God says in a relational universe, you cannot have a relationship if you do not trust the person that you're relating to. And I'm here to tell you that if you'll trust me, you'll have life. That's the issue. And so out of that, chapter 3, verse 11, it is obvious that nobody's going to be justified before God by the works of the law. That is not going to happen. That's a false methodology. And the reason is because Habakkuk makes it so clear that life is the outcome of being right with God by faith, not by performance. Those that are justified by faith will live. Now, we're going to see in the weeks and months and whatever to come, the Lord willing, how that translates into an effective methodology for day-by-day living. But the effective methodology means you start in the right place. And the start is, how do you relate to God so that you're declared righteous by Him? And the answer is, well, you trust Him. You believe Him. He is not going to justify you if you try to say, well, but I did this right and I did that right and I did this right and I did that. You approach Him on the basis of rule keeping and you will come under a curse. You approach Him on the basis of a promise that He's made to you and you say, okay, I'm going to trust you here. It's an altogether different methodology. That's why I pointed that out about that song. You know, somebody will believe if you're just faithful every moment you live. Well, have at it, but it isn't going to work. So, the issue is the methodology, because in Paul's writings, he is very interested in how we function, but he's not interested in how we function if we're not found properly. Galatians is trying to ground us in the truth that will enable us then to function. So we're not going to run into do this and do that until chapter 4, and not even then until we get halfway through the chapter. And even when we do get to the exhortation in chapter 4, the first one, it's not going to be a big do this and don't do that kind of thing. It's going to be an attitude thing. Believe me when I tell you that I love you, and that's why I'm telling you these things. That's basically what chapter 4, verse 12 is saying.